Throughout the 1980s, a strange phenomenon was sweeping North America.
They were in a panic. And like people in a panic, they want solutions.
Allegations of underground satanic cults, torturing and terrorizing children. The thing is, there were no satanic cults preying on children. And nearly 30 years later, the people touched by it all are still picking up the pieces.
This isn't a work of fiction. This is a work of history.
Satanic Panic, available now.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Matt Galloway, and this is The Current Podcast.
If you were to open up your pantry right now, pretty safe bet there would be some sort of pasta in there. Maybe it's macaroni, maybe it's penne, maybe it's bow ties. You ever thought about how well those shapes of pasta are serving you and the sauce that you put on them? Well, Dan Pashman has thought about it quite a bit, actually. Dan hosts the food podcast The Sporkful. A few years ago, he found himself so underwhelmed with what was in his pantry that he invented a brand new shape of pasta. He called it cascatelli. It was very successful. Now he's gone a step further. He's written a cookbook that challenges cooks to think outside the pasta box when it comes to cooking all sorts of shapes of pasta. The book is called Anything's Pastable, 81 Inventive Recipes for Saucy People. Dan Pashman is in New York City. Dan, good morning.
Hey, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So I think the easiest way for people to kind of understand where you're coming from with this book is to go back in history, back to 2018 when this started for you. This is, have a listen to this, a clip from a debate that you hosted. It aired on your podcast. It's called The Bucatini Dialogues.
And I'm just going to go ahead and say it. Spaghetti sucks. Thank you. I said it. It's round on the outside. That means that it's a low surface area in relation to the volume. That means that sauce doesn't adhere to it well. It means less of it contacts your teeth when you first bite it. There's all this romanticism around spaghetti, but spaghetti and meatballs isn't even an Italian thing. All right, like The Lady and the Tramp did a great disservice to American culinary history by romanticizing spaghetti. You know, what we really should have taken from that movie is that it's a pasta shape that's only fit for dogs.
Dan, what's going on there?
Well, yeah, I continue to not be super impressed with spaghetti, Matt. I mean, I have these three metrics that I came up with to judge all pasta shapes. Mm-hmm. So there's forkability, how easy is it to get it on the fork and keep it there? Then there's sauceability, how well does sauce adhere to the shape? And finally, tooth sink ability, which is how satisfying is it to sink your teeth into it. And I think a lot of shapes out there are good at one or two of those. Very few nail all three. Spaghetti barely gets one. I mean, like, you know, try to get a good bite of spaghetti on a fork. It's always, you twirl it. It's always either too big or too small. It's got danglers that are going to smear sauce all over your face. Then you finish all the spaghetti and half the sauce is still sitting on the plate. You know, that's a design flaw. And so based on those dissatisfactions, I set out to invent a new and better shape of pasta. And the result after 3 years of trial and error and a lot of naysaying from the entire pasta industry and my wife,
Just about everybody.
Everyone told me it was a terrible idea, but I came out with cascatelli, which has a variety of sort of more elaborate special features than some of the more basic pastas. It has these two sort of parallel spines of ruffles that protrude out from the main body. It's a short shape. Sauce gets in there between those ruffles, and it can't get out.
The shape matters, but the name is also really important. And I mean, you very nearly named it something else, right? I want to play. This is what happened when you ran that name by your family.
I'm going to show you and tell you one proposed name for my pasta shape, and I want you to tell me your first reaction. Millepiedi.
I think it's, I wouldn't really know how to pronounce it, and it sounds a little bit like an insect with many legs.
And how do you feel about it sounding like that?
Not what I want my pasta to be called.
Emily?
Well, I don't really like millepiedi because I kind of feel like it's hard to pronounce and it's just not a good pasta name.
Your family are really hard on you.
They have, yeah, well, that's my wife and my younger daughter, Emily, in that clip. And yeah, they're, I mean, you know, look, Matt, you need people who are going to give you honest feedback in any creative pursuit and in life. And they do that very well. Sometimes a little too honest. Yeah. But I think that they were right that Millepiedi was not a great name for a pasta shape. I wanted to name my pasta shape. My favorite names for shapes in general are when it's the Italian word for a thing that the shape looks like. Yeah. Which is, so like, fettuccine means ribbons, penne means pens, like quill pens, because it has a pointy end, orecchiette, little ears, radiatore, radiators. And so I knew I wanted a name, you know, I didn't want to give it a gimmicky name. I wanted it to sound like a timeless pasta shape that's always been around. And so once it was done, I started showing it to people, saying, what does this look like to you? And then I would look up the Italian word for that thing. And if you hold it in a certain position, it looks a bit like a millipede. And so I tried that out, but that got vetoed. And I ended up with cascatelli, which is Italian for waterfalls, because if you hold it vertically, the two ruffles sort of look like flowing water. And I think that's ended up being a good choice. So my family was right.
They were right. The story of this has, been well told and is wildly successful. Aside from the fact that it's hard to get in Canada, how successful has this experiment been for you?
I mean, certainly it's surpassed all my wildest expectations. I mean, I think the most kind of pie in the sky idea I had in my head before it launched for what would be success would be like, I just had it in my head. I was like, it'd be so cool if it was in stores. Because initially when it first launched, we were just selling it online. I teamed up with an American pasta company called Sfoglini, Sfoglini. And I teamed up with them and we were just going to sell it through the website and see how it went. And that was so successful that then it went into stores. Now there's a version at Trader Joe's. There's a version that Bonza makes. It's in Whole Foods, at least in the U.S., not sure about Canada. But so the fact that years later I can still go into a store and buy it is incredible. And I still do that. I mean, like, even though I don't have to, I still buy it when I see it in a store because I just get excited.
Having invented something, why did you feel like you needed to write a book that would add on to this? Inventing something is enough. You've never written a cookbook before.
That's true. I mean, I wrote a book about 10 years ago that was not a cookbook. I've done a lot of writing over the course of my career. Yeah. So writing a successful book was kind of a dream of mine, a goal that I had. The first book I did wasn't so successful. And while I think it had some parts of it that I still really love, there were other parts of it that were a bit flawed, and I think I learned a lot from that process. And so when Cascatelli came out and it went viral, everyone's sending me pictures from all over North America, all over the world of what they're making with it, and that's incredible. But there was a problem, and that is that a lot of the photos, I mean, I would say 75% of the photos were tomato sauce, meat sauce, mac and cheese, maybe pesto. And just, you know, Cascatelli aside, just speaking more broadly about pasta, that just made me kind of sad because there's so much more that we can and should be putting on our pasta shapes. There's so many other great pasta dishes out there, and it made me curious about what new ideas there might be as yet unexplored in pasta. And so I set out to write a cookbook that would answer that question and to show people there's so much more we can and should be putting on our pasta beyond the basics, beyond tomato sauce and bolognese and those classics.
But you would know that, I mean, there are a lot of books out about pasta and how to dress it, how to sauce it, how to think about it. What did you want to do that was different? I mean, you've put together, as part of the Sporkful podcast, this little four-part series on creating the cookbook. And it begins with this idea of what is it that you're going to make? What did you want to do?
Yes, there are a lot of pasta cookbooks out there, but I think that, frankly, I'm surprised at how many cookbooks get printed that have roughly the same set of recipes. Mm-hmm. I'm not against tomato sauce or lasagna or basic pesto, but I just don't think the world needs any more recipes for those things. And I also think that, like, there's almost become a sort of a stock stereotype of these types of cookbooks that are, you know, the pictures of the sort of the nonas in aprons caked in flour and the rolling hills of Tuscany, and it's the same 25 to 50 dishes over and over again. And so, first off, I know that there's more out there in Italian pasta dishes, but also I wanted to break out beyond Italian food and beyond Italian ingredients. I mean, the truth is I cook with a wide range of ingredients and across a wide range of cuisines in my own kitchen. And I sometimes mash up these different ingredients with pasta in my own cooking. I have leftover, I make some Indian dal. I have some leftover pasta. They're both leftovers in the fridge. One day I'm like, I'm going to put these together. That ended up being a recipe in the cookbook, mac and dal. I put chili crisp in just about anything anything that needs a little something. My first thought is I'm going to open up a jar of chili crisp. So the idea of doing cacio e pepe with chili crisp in the cookbook felt natural. I love shakshuka, North African Middle Eastern dish of the stewed tomatoes with the eggs on top. And I was like, I make that with my family. Why not put pasta in it? It's already tomato-based sauce. So these were some of the ideas that were kind of floating around in my head. And I just felt like, while there are a lot of pasta cookbooks out there, I think that they're often a bit redundant and and narrow. So I set out with this goal of, you know, saying, what else can we do? Well, there's kimchi carbonara in this cookbook. So, for instance, we have cavatelli with roasted artichokes and preserved lemon. In Italy, they would do artichokes with lemon juice. Instead, we're doing preserved lemon, which I love. It's a dish, again, you see North Africa and the Middle East that is more savory, more of a strong lemony flavor. And so those kinds of things, to me, really took pasta to a new level.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
In the podcast, somebody calls you an explorer. And the tagline for this pork full, of course, is for eaters, not for foodies. What does that mean in terms of how you approach food, in terms of what happens when you open the fridge or the cupboard?
Yeah, I mean, first off, I'm not a chef. I have no professional culinary expertise whatsoever. So for this cookbook, I worked with an incredibly talented team of recipe developers and collaborated with them to make these great recipes that I would never have been able to do on my own. And that also informs my approach on the Sporkful, like you said, which is our motto is it's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I mean, to me, foodies are very preoccupied with who are the hot chefs and what are the hot restaurants, and not only going to those places and sharing about it on social media, but then bragging to their friends about where they've been and who they know and what they know. And I like that whole sort of conflation of eating in certain restaurants with status is just very off-putting to me and frankly disinteresting. I just don't care. I don't care who the hot new chef of the moment is or what the hot new place is. I don't want to go to a restaurant where I'm going to have to wait a long time for my table or where I can't get a reservation. So I just love to eat. I love food, and I am interested in trying new things and exploring and mashing things up and trying new ideas. But I don't care about food as status. And that, to me, is what the difference is between foodies and eaters.
You are a food-obsessed weirdo.
Yes. I think that's what how I refer to myself in the introduction to the cookbook. Yeah. So, yes, I will take that label, Matt.
You're also not Italian. So does that – I mean, again, and this goes back to all of those books, as you said, with the Nonas in the rolling hills of Tuscany who are 95 years old and they can still roll out pasta by hand every day. Do people look at you askance when you say you're going to write – not even invent a pasta, but write a book, a cookbook about pasta, and you're not Italian?
Yes, they do. You know, and look, I think that anytime you're approaching any cuisine, you should take the time to learn about it and research it and approach it with respect, as I have. I mean, I spent years learning about how pasta was made before I invented my own shape, and I did a research trip across Italy and talked with a number of experts in preparation to work on this book. That being said, I do think that sometimes having a bit of an outsider's perspective can help you to identify new ideas. When I did my research trip across Italy, the most shocking thing about it, the thing that I most took home was that I learned that pasta only became the national food of Italy about 100 years ago. Italy only became a country 150 years ago or so. And so the fascist government of the time wanted to unite this sort of fractious country under one nationalist identity. They needed to feed the masses cheaply. They decided pasta was the key. So there's all this fascist propaganda about pasta. The government started building pasta factories in places in Italy where there were none before. And that was what spread pasta. And it was really throughout the 20th century that it grew and evolved and new ideas in pasta came to play. For instance, carbonara. I would have guessed that the Roman emperors were eating carbonara centuries ago. Turns out it was invented in the 1940s, and only because American soldiers were in Italy during World War II and their rations of bacon and eggs made their way into Italian kitchens, which is how we ended up with carbonara as the raw beaten eggs, the cured pork, pepper and cheese. But even for decades after that initial moment in the 40s and 50s, the recipes for carbonara varied widely. The Italian sort of culinary world and home cooks did not agree on a recipe for carbonara until about 30 years ago. Only then was it standardized. There's other new dishes coming about in Italy, one called spaghetti all'assassina that I went to research in the city of Bari, where it's from, where you pan fry spaghetti in this spicy tomato sauce till it turns cooks down to a tomato paste, and you keep pan frying it till some bits are charred and crunchy, some bits are golden brown and crispy, and some bits are still chewy. That was invented in 1960, and new versions of spaghetti all'assassine, which means assassin spaghetti, are being introduced in Bari even in recent years. And so the fact is that Italian food history and Italian pasta culture are not as static and as old as we have been led to believe.
It's so interesting because there's this idea, and I mean, you mentioned carbonara, like that there are four great Roman pastas, right? The Gricia, the Cacio e Pepe, the carbonara, and the Mitra Ciana.
Right.
And that those you can't mess with those. Those are the building blocks, and you play with the foundation and the whole house will collapse. And you're saying that that's not the case.
That's right. I mean, look, food culture evolves. It is one of the most basic rules of humanity, and especially as human beings travel around the world and bring their foods and their culture with them, food culture will change and evolve. Human beings are always going to be looking for new ideas. Italy is not immune from that process. And yes, of course, look, the tradition and history of Italian food is beautiful, and I love it. It's one of the great things about being in Italy, but there's also been a lot of mythologizing around that. And to me, I find that exciting. You know, I started off thinking of my cookbook as sort of kicking down the door of Italian food, but I came to see it more as a contribution to the ongoing and never-ending evolution of pasta.
Where did the idea for the kimchi carbonara come from? Again, those are two things. You can talk about the evolution of food, but I think those are two things that people may not automatically bring together in a bowl or on a plate.
It's true, they may not, but I mean, that idea in particular came from a recipe developer I worked with in the book named Irene Yu, who's super talented. She had done a recipe for something like a kimchi carbonara that I found online, so I reached out to her. We adapted it for my cookbook, and it's a phenomenal combination. When you saute kimchi in a pan, it becomes a little less spicy, less acidic. The cabbage softens a bit. The whole thing mellows beautifully, but it still maintains some spice, some acidity, and some crunch, which contrasts beautifully with the rich creaminess of the raw beaten eggs and the salty smokiness of the guanciale and the black pepper. It just comes together so nicely. But to me, it's really, you know, look, I think across North America, our food culture is becoming more diverse. A wider range of cuisines and ingredients are working their way into the mainstream. I certainly cook with a wider range of ingredients today than I grew up eating. And I think that it's only natural that we start to mash these things up. You know, I think there's this misconception that new ideas in food only come from fancy chefs. But often they come from home cooks who just happen to have a couple of things in their pantry and decide to put them together and see what happens. Mm. And, you know, to me, I find that very exciting. I love to see how those ideas come together. We have a recipe in the cookbook for a keema bolognese, which to me feels natural. Keema, the classic spiced ground meat dish from India. Bolognese, the classic ground meat sauce from Italy. But, you know, it's very common to do ground meat sauces in Italian pasta culture. Why not take a ground meat dish like keema and mash it up and bring in some of those Indian flavors? So, you know, to me, that's the kind of idea that when you start thinking about bringing together different cuisines comes naturally.
The test, as you say, is the can I stop eating it test.
Yes.
Which sounds obvious, but it's like if you can't put it down, then it's got
to
be good.
Right. That was my threshold for dishes that I tested to make it into the book. You know, you cook it, you serve it, you sit down, you eat it, and then it's time to clean up. And the question is like, how much of the pasta, leftover pasta makes it from the pot into the leftover container that goes into the fridge? And how much continues to get eaten during the cleanup process? And if it's too easy to clean up without eating more, then that pasta dish is not really a winner. You know, you have to be like, but I just want one more bite. Oh, but just one more bite. And if you're feeling that way, then you know it's a real winner.
One of the things you mentioned, you know, people will often improvise because of what's in their cupboard. One of the things that people will have in their cupboard often is a jar of tomato sauce. And that can just be boring, or you can make it funkier and more interesting if you follow the jarred pasta decision tree.
That's right. You know, early on in the process of working on this cookbook, I tested a sirloin ragu. It was a slow-cooked tomato-based meat sauce, but with a nice piece of steak in it. And it was good. It was very good. It was very good, but it was similar. It was a slightly better version of a lot of tomato-based meat sauces I've had before. And it took almost 2 hours to make it. And in that moment, Matt, I made a declaration. I said, I'm not going to put any tomato-based sauces because I've just eaten so much tomato sauce in my life. I'm not going to put any tomato-based sauces in this book unless they're really different from anything I've had before or ridiculously easy. Mm. And for the ridiculously easy portion, I say just use jarred sauce. There are so many good, high-quality jarred tomato sauces on the market nowadays. Find whichever one you like the best. There's no reason to be spending hours cooking marinara sauce when you can buy a great jar of it. And so instead, I give you the jarred tomato sauce decision tree. So you start with a jar of sauce, and then you answer my questions, follow the prompts in this graphic. Do you want it heartier? Do you want it spicier? Do you want it more savory?
Do you want it Italian or Indian? Which is not a decision with jarred tomato sauce that perhaps people are thinking of.
Exactly. But so I sort of push you to ask yourself questions you might not have considered. And as you follow the prompts, it's sort of a choose your own adventure. You can end up with one of about 15 different outcomes for how you can doctor a jar of sauce to make it more interesting.
Is there one recipe in here that you're proudest of in this book?
I mean, that's, you know, it really depends on my mood on a given day.
Is there one that your family, because part of this in the podcast is you're kind of road testing some of these things, and sometimes it works. And then I think one of your kids says that one of the recipes is like a call for help.
Right.
is there one thing that the harsh critics at home loved?
I mean, my whole family loves the scallion oil bucatini with runny eggs. Mm. It's a very simple sauce, but it combines fried scallions with raw scallions. And it's a sauce of soy sauce, lemon, and butter. And you cook runny, you know, sunny side up eggs, and you put them on top of the pasta and then break the yolk. So the yolk runs down into the sauce and you get the crunch of the scallions. And all the different flavors. That one, they absolutely adore. I also, I personally really love the cavatelli with roasted artichokes and preserved lemon, which, you know, typically Italians, I think I said this before, but I'll say it again. Typically Italians would do artichokes and lemon juice. This one is preserved lemon. And so that one also just is another phenomenal one. There's also one I came up with, Matt, called pasta pizza, which is a pizza where the crust is made of pasta.
Yeah.
And that, again, I say use jarred sauce for your tomato sauce, but you follow the instructions and it's crispy on the bottom. You can cut slices out of it and pick it up and eat it with your hands.
There are a lot of different kinds of food, but and I rarely get to quote Fellini on this program, but Fellini said, life is a combination of magic and pasta. What is it about pasta?
Well, I think that carbs in general, and you know, across the cuisines of the world, almost every cuisine has some kind of a carb base, whether it's pasta, rice, bread, or others. And I think that there's something just that scratches very deep evolutionary comfort food itch when you start with a base of carbs. And it's warming, it's comforting, but so it has a very satisfying texture and it has a very comforting component to it, but it's very mild in flavor, which makes it a blank canvas and allows you to add a lot of different kinds of things on it. And so I love all the carb bases of the world and especially pasta.
This just feels like such an extension of the work that you do on The Sporkful. You've been doing it for how long now? Has that podcast been?
14 years.
14 years. So where do you think that podcast lands in terms of its place in how we talk about food?
Wow. I mean, I'd be excited for it to have a place at all, but...
You know that it's done something though, right? To how we think about food and how... I mean, it's about food, but it's about people.
I hope so. Yeah. I mean, right. I mean, I think that... You know, people hear that I have a food podcast and they assume it's like, oh, so you do recipes? So it's about healthy eating? Oh, so you interview chefs? Not really. I mean, once in a while we interview chefs, but we really say it's more like we're using food to tell stories. I mean, I've come to believe that you can, you know, when you start off talking about food, you can end up talking about culture, identity, history, science, economics, or the best way to layer a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, you know, or relationships, love and marriage. I mean, you can get into anything. And so... I hope that The Sporkful has made a contribution to getting people to realize that, you know, with every bite you take, you're kind of like unlocking a story. It could be a story about you, about the world, about history. And there's so much that you can explore just with every bite of food if you just take a minute and think a little bit more deeply about it.
Do you know what you're making for dinner tonight?
Well, now I'm in the mood for pasta, of course. I think my younger daughter has been asking for the vodka sauce with tomato achar. Achar is an Indian spiced relish, pickle relish. That recipe from my cookbook. I haven't made it in a while. My younger one, Emily, has been asking for it, so I think we'll go with that.
The great praise, I think, that you can offer a cookbook author or somebody who's written a cookbook is that it makes you hungry when you read it. And the book does just that. Dan, it's great to talk to you.
Thank you, Matt. I appreciate it.
Dan Pashman is the host of the Sporkful podcast and the author of a new cookbook called Anything's Possible. He's also the inventor of Cascatelli. It's a new pasta shape, not yet widely available in Canada, but he assures us that he is working on that.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.